Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Genesis by Paul Chafe, narrated by James Anderson Foster. Prelude. Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven. Genesis chapter 1, verse 14. L-135. Crockery smashed downstairs and angry voices came down the corridor. Josh Crewe woke, eyes staring at the darkened ceiling, afraid. He swallowed hard and listened carefully, gauging the swell of the fight as his parents savaged each other with accusation and recrimination. He didn't understand the words, but he didn't need to. What was important was their intensity. If the fight grew bad enough, there would be footsteps on the stairs, and the lights in his room would snap on so Mother could drag him out of bed, to use as a living example of his father's failures before God and man. It would mean no sleep, perhaps getting smacked in the face by his father when the hurt and humiliation finally overcame the man, and he lashed out himself. That was minor. Father's anger came and went with a single blow, predictable and not so dangerous, however painful. It was Mother who really scared him. Once she had nearly drowned him in a scalding hot bath because he'd tracked mud into the hallway. Another time she'd made him kneel in the gravel driveway all night, praying for forgiveness for bringing a toy to church. Mother was unpredictable and therefore dangerous. The voices rose higher and more crashing came from downstairs. He slipped out of the bed and dressed himself quickly and quietly, then went to the hot air register beneath the window and removed the grill. He snaked an arm down the vent. The fit was almost too tight now that he was 12. An adult wouldn't have been able to do it, which is why he used it as his secret hiding place. He'd grown, and his biceps caught painfully on the sharp-edged metal before his fingers found what he was looking for. He stretched, feeling the metal dig in and ignoring the hurt until he touched something. The end cap of a prescription medicine bottle. He teased it closer with his fingertips until he could grab the bottle and drew his arm out. The bottle was transparent plastic, one of many kicking around the house that bore the white sticky label reading, Crewe, Evelyn, Primidone, 50 milligrams 3 times daily. It was stuffed full of money, coins, and bills. He had hoarded it carefully, some saved from his allowance when his parents remembered to give it to him, more stolen a bit at a time from his mother's cigarette money, his emergency fund. And the emergency was now. He took a pair of packed book bags from beneath a pile of clothes in the mess that was his closet, picked up his shoes, and padded across the hall to his sister's room. She was sound asleep. "Susie," he shook her. "Susie, wake up." She stirred, and her eyes opened. He saw in her face the immediate recognition of the situation. "Are we going outside again?" Josh nodded. "Yes." He didn't tell her the whole plan. She nodded and dressed without words, tension in her face as the shouting downstairs grew louder. They went back to his room, slid the window open, and climbed out onto the veranda. The jump from there to the maple tree was a frightening one for a 12-year-old, even more so for a 10-year-old. For a moment, Josh was afraid that Susie would freeze there as she had one night before, tears running down her face as he tried to coax her across. That night had been bad. They'd been caught, and for the first time, Father's anger hadn't vanished with the first hit. Something had snapped in him, and he'd beaten Josh, knelt on his arms so he couldn't protect himself, and smashed his fist down over and over until his nose was broken, his face bruised and bloody. It had been terrifying, more terrifying than anything his mother had done, because his prediction had been wrong. Something had changed in his father, and there was no telling what that would bring. It would have been better if they hadn't been caught, if they'd snuck back in at daybreak after the fight had burned itself out. Even if they'd been found missing in the middle of the night, nothing would have been said. Nothing was ever said afterward. It was as if the fights were a secret the Crewe family kept from itself. He dropped the book bags over the veranda. The tree was there, dark in the chill breeze of an autumn night, and he put a practiced foot on the railing and swung a leg across and felt for the broken branch stub that was the only foothold on this side of the tree. He braced himself against the veranda rail and pushed off, balanced for a brief second only on the foot on the branch stub, and then he caught the tree trunk. At least it hadn't been Susie beaten that night. Josh had been angry at his sister for getting them caught. It wasn't fair that he was the only one punished, and the injustice of it burned deep in him. It was always that way. He was the scapegoat, and she the favorite. It was his own fault. He took the blame, protected her, diverted their parents' attention away from her transgressions because he was older, stronger, tougher than she was. It was what he had to do. He didn't know why, and the knowledge of what he was doing didn't make it hurt less. He scrambled down the tree trunk, balanced on the fence for a second, and hopped to the ground, then turned back to look to see if Susie was following him. She edged out around the veranda railing and stopped. For a moment, he thought she had frozen again, but she had learned her lesson and reached her foot out, feeling for the branch stub. She was shorter than he was, and it was a harder stretch for her. Her foot found the branch, and then she was straddling the gap 15 feet up. She moved to shift her weight to grab the tree trunk, swayed dangerously, and clutched the veranda railing to steady herself. "I can't, Josh." He could hear the fear in her voice. "You've done it before." "I'm stuck." She was on the verge of tears. "I'll come and get you." He couldn't do anything for her, he knew, but he had to show her he was trying. He climbed up the fence and shinnied up the tree, reached out for her. "Here, just grab my hand." She looked at him, her eyes large and frightened. Angry voices came from inside the house, muffled by the walls, and she moved all at once, suddenly motivated. He grabbed her wrist and pulled, and then she was safe in the tree, and they were climbing down, the rough bark tearing at their hands until they were on the ground. "Are we going to the park?" She was calmer now as they walked down the driveway, leaving the scene behind them. The park was where they usually waited out the fights. "Somewhere else." He picked up the book bags and handed hers to her, then slid a hand into his pocket to verify that the medicine bottle was still there. "We'll get in trouble when we get back." "Not this time." He helped her slip the straps over her shoulders. They walked down the familiar street in silence, past the old towering trees and the lit windows of the neighboring houses, feeling a sudden nervousness. Getting out when he had to was something he had been ready for, just a variation on the familiar theme of getting out of the way. But as bad and frightening as things were at home, they were also known quantities, and the world opening up before him was vast and unknown and full of threats he could only imagine. He resisted the urge to turn around and look back at his house, knowing he would never see it again. Something tugged at him, the desire for warmth, for comfort, for safety. The house was all those things when his parents weren't fighting. When they weren't, it was even a nice place to live, bright and spacious. Everything he owned was there. His friends lived in the neighborhood. He fingered his cheek. It had been months, maybe longer, though the memory of the flaring pain of his father's fist never seemed to leave it. He blinked back tears that came too easily at the memory. It was dangerous for him to stay now, because next time it would be worse. He had to leave, and he couldn't leave Susie behind to face their parents alone. "Where are we going?" Susie's question was plaintive. "Far away." "How far?" To tell her or not to tell her. They were out of the house now. It was too late for her to go back. "We're going to Aunt Krista's."
"On a plane?"
"On a bus." They turned left to head toward downtown. He had expected her to balk at that. Her answer surprised him.
"Is that far enough?"
"It's far enough," he said. But his confidence that it was far enough was rattled just by her uncertainty. What if it wasn't? What if Aunt Krista made them go back?
"I don't like it when they're mean to you, Joshy."
She slipped a small hand into his, holding it tightly. "They won't ever be again." Overhead, the streetlights flickered and went dark. Evening blackout. Most people avoided going out after blackout, but Josh was used to it. The darkness was a friend that helped him hide from danger.
Can we go further? If we had to, I mean?
Susie was looking over her shoulder, worry written on her small features. If we have to, we can.
How far could we go?
The question took him aback, and he stopped to look at her. Her face was open and worried, and he saw her real question written there. Can they ever take us back? And he didn't know the answer to that, and he didn't want her to see his own fear and uncertainty. He pointed up to the sky, frosted, bright with stars and a brilliant half-moon, now that the competing city lights were gone.
See that star?
Which one?
The bright one.
He picked one at random and pointed more specifically. That's Alpha Centauri. It's got a planet just like ours. We could go there. They could never get us back from there.
Can we really?
They could send a ship. I read about it.
I want to go there now.
We can't yet. Maybe later.
If we can't stay at Aunt Krista's, can we go there?
Yes. Josh squeezed her hand reassuringly, not mentioning that the book on space in the school library had said it was unlikely people could live on any of the distant worlds discovered so far, or that the ship that could carry them there existed only in a speculative chapter at the book's end. They trudged on in the chill night air, and mentally he rehearsed what he would say at the bus station. I'd like 2 tickets for Sacramento, please. That's in California. The bus company wouldn't let children travel unaccompanied, so he'd tell the driver his mom would be along shortly, and with luck, that would get them on the bus. It was a 3-day journey to California. He had enough money for their tickets, enough for food for that time, barely. They had enough clothing in the book bags, and they would sleep on the bus or in the bus stations. 3 days of fending for themselves, and then they'd be safe. Reflexively, he patted the back pocket of the backpack, felt the reassuring crinkle of paper. He'd looked it all up and written it down, the schedules and fares and timetables, maps of the area around each bus terminal, and most important, Aunt Krista's full name and address. If they got stopped anywhere, the police would get involved eventually, and he would tell them that Aunt Krista was their mother. With luck, that would get them to Sacramento just as well. 2 runaways returned to their family, but it would be better, far better, to arrive in Sacramento on their own and plead their case to Aunt Krista on her doorstep. He glanced overhead at the star he had named Alpha Centauri. Aunt Krista would look after them, he was sure, and if she couldn't, well, they would just keep running, as far as they had to. He squeezed Susie's hand again, was rewarded with her brave, trusting smile, and felt a sense of pride overtake the fear and uncertainty. She was his baby sister, and he would look after her no matter where they went, always. Genesis 1. The Almighty has his own purposes. Abraham Lincoln. L-95.
Go right in, Dr. Crewe.
The secretary was blonde with a stylish reserve.
The chairman is waiting for you.
She smiled a less reserved smile than she had been trained to give, enough to hint that perhaps she could make herself available after work if Josh Crewe dared to ask. He was handsome, with a hint of distinguishing gray at his temples, and the casual authority of a man accustomed to being in charge. She watched as he went through the heavy oak doors, still lean in his lower 50s, old enough to be her father, but still attractive. The doors closed behind him, and she looked out the panoramic windows, far away for a long moment. The lights were bright in the Aerospace Consortium's lobby, and a miniature waterfall splashed down one wall. The power-wasting luxuries were tangible displays of the consortium's wealth in a world where too many people competed for too little. The luxuries made her own cramped flat with its 2 puny light panels seem even more dingy and run down. She looked to the doors, imagining what life would be like with a man rich enough and powerful enough that she would never have to worry about material needs again. She smiled, daydreaming, never being hungry. Hot showers whenever she wanted them, the freedom to stay up late reading without worrying about what it was costing her. That was the way things were meant to be.
Assemblyist Crewe, how can I help the United Nations today?
Harmon Michaud's office was immaculate and expensively appointed, as befitted the chairman of the Aerospace Consortium. His desk held a notepad, a screen, and a few models of famous air and spacecraft. Nothing else. Michaud dressed in expensive and restrained taste, and his keen eyes assessed his visitor dispassionately. Crewe took one of the plush leather seats. "You may have heard I'm planning to run for Secretary General."
"There have been rumors."
Crewe spread his hands. "The rumors are true. I need your support."
"Huh."
Michaud steepled his fingers.
"What support can we give you?"
"Money and influence. What else is there?"
"And to ask the obvious question, what is in it for the aerospace industry?"
Crewe picked up a small silver cylinder from Michaud's desk. It had a shiny mylar parabola attached, a model of one of a sensor swarm probe. The model was full-sized except for the solar sail, which would have been miles across. "How would you like to see another deep space exploration program launched?"
"I wouldn't be uninterested, but frankly, Dr. Crewe, there isn't a lot of money to be made in pure research."
"That could change."
"It could." Michaud stroked his chin, thinking. "It will be difficult for you to convince me that you're the person to change it, given you're the one most responsible for legislating profit limits on government-funded research. That puts a negative spin on what I've done. And how would you spin it? I would say that I've acted to maximize the amount of research we've been able to do on a strictly limited budget. I've also fought hardest to increase that budget for you. My companies are interested in profits, not volume.
Volume brings profits to efficient competitors. Your industry is a lot leaner and more aggressive now. I'd like to think I've helped set the conditions to make that true."
"And did you do that for us, or for your own purposes?"
"Does it matter, so long as my purpose overlaps with your business model?"
"It matters."
Crewe nodded. "I'll make you a promise, my first campaign promise. More money for space industry. Deep space exploration revived." Michaud waved a hand.
"Space represents a few percent of the aerospace market at most. Research is a fraction of that. I'd rather see energy credits for commercial air carriers."
"You won't see that." Crewe's voice was flatter than he meant it to be. "That's a mature market." Michaud arched his eyebrows.
"Perhaps I'll see subsidies if I support Assemblyist Plant instead of you."
"Plant is running with the support of the Believers. Even if he were inclined to give you subsidies, his constituency wouldn't allow it." Michaud laughed mirthlessly.
"Politics is the process of getting money from the rich and votes from the poor by exploiting their fear of each other. I have no doubt that Markham Plant will do what he has to do to gain the office he seeks. He may have to be more circumspect about how he presents an aerospace subsidy to the public than you would, but I have no doubt he'll repay loyalty in good measure. What will you do for me if I give you my support?"
"You'll see me encourage your industry to align its efforts with the long-term best interests of the world." Michaud laughed again, with more humor this time.
"You have a certain naive charm, Dr. Crewe. Still, I don't see how I'll benefit from supporting you."
Crewe paused, studying the other man. "I have something else to offer. You'll have to keep it in strictest confidence." Michaud leaned forward.
"What is it?"
"Iota Horologii."
"What?"
"A class G0 star. Its second planet has a nitrogen-oxygen atmosphere. There's life there. It may be inhabitable for people." Michaud nodded.
"I remember this now. Proof of life beyond the solar system. Exciting news, 5 years ago. You won't gain any support with this."
"What about launching a colony ship?"
Michaud raised his eyebrows. "Dr. Crewe, I'm not unfamiliar with your work on interstellar ship design, but this is not possible. We don't have the technology."
"What do you care, so long as your industry gets paid to try?"
Michaud picked up the model probe that Crewe had put down. "These get up to 10% of light speed by the time they leave the system. Interstellar gas comes in like hard cosmic rays. Your seed ship will fly slower. I could imagine as much as 1% of light speed with a speed-optimized design, but even so, I can't imagine an embryo surviving that environment, to say nothing of gestating them at the far end. I'm not talking about embryos. I'm talking about people. Not a seed ship, but a colony ship. Michaud snorted. You can't be serious. I'm quite serious. I've looked at the problem from every angle. You're right about radiation flux, and there are other problems, like breaking at the far end, like somehow raising a bunch of embryos into a competent colonization team. Seed ships are an impossible dream. And somehow sending a person isn't? Say your ship weighs 1,000 metric tons, which is ridiculously conservative. Michaud looked away for a second while he ran the numbers in his head. There wouldn't be enough energy in the world to launch that even to Alpha Centauri within a human lifetime. Think larger. The ship will weigh 1 billion tons. Michaud's jaw didn't quite drop. Impossible. Trip time is on the order of 10,000 years, assuming we still want to go to Iota Horologii by the time it's ready to launch. Josh Crewe smiled, appearing to enjoy Michaud's incredulity. We may decide to change the destination. We're sure to learn a lot more by then. There may be closer worlds, and better. It would take 100 years to build such a thing. Again, does that matter to you? The Aerospace Consortium will be a thriving concern for your great-grandchildren. Michaud considered. No, perhaps it doesn't matter. He paused, contemplating his steepled fingers. I have a question for you. What is it? Why? Crewe paused, choosing his words carefully. Because humanity's destiny is in the stars. No doubt, but what I want to know is why you in particular are committed to that destiny. Michaud leaned forward, his eyes locked on Crewe's. I know your history, Dr. Crewe. He slid a piece of paper out of a folder on his desk and read from it. Parents divorced, raised by your aunt. Your sister died at age 19. If Michaud caught the momentary tightening of Crewe's expression at those words, he gave no notice. No other close relatives. Top honors at Caltech in aerospace engineering. 7 years at Boeing, 5 at Aerospatiale. Left there for academia and taught at Oxford for 4 years, then Samara State Aerospace University in Russia for another 4. Fluent in English, French, and Russian, with a passable knowledge of Arabic and Chinese. 5 years ago, you abandoned the ivory tower for politics, first regional and now global. As UN Secretary of Transportation, you have been, if I may be frank, a persistent thorn in the side of the aerospace industry. You remain unmarried despite occasional attachments, and you show no signs of settling down anytime soon. You have little contact with your aunt, none with your parents, and your sister is dead. With no impediments, you've been free to do as you choose, and you've made good use of that freedom. Your achievements show you're an intelligent man. Your life shows you to be a driven one, too. You are, accordingly, a man to be reckoned with. Harmon leaned back, steepling his fingers. Before I throw my support to such a man, I want to know where that drive comes from, the better to predict where he will go. I will go to the stars. Again, why? Because we can. Because they're there. There are no more frontiers on Earth, not mountains, not ocean depths, not even the solar system anymore. We have solved all the great problems of science and as many of those of humanity as I believe are solvable. We must have challenges, something to inspire us outward, or we will turn inward and collapse. Michaud cocked an eyebrow. If you were still a scientist, I might believe you believed that. But not now. Those words will play too well on a news feed for me to give them credibility. Why do you think I left science for politics, if not to see this ship made? Crewe's eyes searched the other man's face. I see you still doubt me. I'll give you the best proof I can. 5 years ago, we found a habitable world at Iota Horologii. 5 years ago, I left my research for politics. I did that to gain the power I needed to make this voyage real. You'll never live to see this ship launched. King Cheops never lived to see his pyramid completed. He still made building it his life work. Is that what you want? Your memory carried down the generations through this vast project? Misho snorted. A pyramid won't buy you immortality.
Not for me. It will for the human race. If we're going to survive, we need to leave this planet. Our civilization can't last forever.
Misho shook his head. Your thinking is fuzzy. Every generation thinks it's the last one. Death by a comet or an ice age, greenhouse gases or nuclear war or global plague. Death by divine decree, if nothing else. A life in politics has rusted your scientific method, Dr. Crew. Those challenges have all been faced and conquered. There's no evidence that the world is about to end.
I don't think our generation is the last one. That's not the same as realizing that civilizations have a lifespan. There have been hundreds of civilizations since the dawn of history. They last 435 years on average. We're already living on borrowed time.
That average doesn't apply to us. We aren't Easter Islanders or Hittites building idols of stone and temples out of logs. We aren't even the Greeks or the Romans. There's never been a civilization even a tenth the size of ours. Never been one that includes every nation on every continent. We command technologies our ancestors couldn't dream of. We can avert comets, cure plagues, adjust the thermal balance of the globe as we need to. War is a memory. Humanity has come into its adulthood, and our childhood afflictions are behind us.
Which doesn't exempt us from resource depletion. Most civilizations die of starvation. We have 12 billion people chewing through more power and resources in an hour than most of humanity's civilizations used in their entire history. That simply can't last.
Misho shrugged. So, if civilization must fall, it must rise again. History shows that, too. And certainly neither you nor I nor our children will have to deal with it.
Crew shook his head. No. This is where our civilization really is different. We've exhausted all the easy resources, coal and oil and uranium, even copper and iron and tin. What's left takes high technology to extract. If the technology is lost, there are no more stepping stones out of the Stone Age. And when the end comes, it will be the final end. We mark the ages of humanity by the raw materials they use. The Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. The Industrial Revolution began the fossil fuel age, though we don't call it that. We're in the Energy Age now. Power is the most basic raw material we have. With it, we can do anything. Without it, we can do nothing. We've had power shortages in North America since I was young. Now they're severe. The rest of the world is caught up in power consumption per capita, but now the number of available kilowatts per person is falling. World population is still going up. You do the math. In a few years, those shortages will be worldwide. This planet can't support 12 billion people without high technology. We've used up our world, and sooner or later, a lot of people are going to die. If our species is to survive, we must claim the stars.
Misho nodded. You've convinced me, Dr. Crew. I don't think your hypothesis is true, but I think you do.
He smiled without humor.
You don't want to build your pyramid for personal glory, but because you truly believe it will bring the favor of the gods. You are an idealist, and more dangerous than I thought.
Crew spread his arms wide.
When Cheops built his pyramid, his quarrymaster became a wealthy man. Harness me, then, for your own ends or oppose me to our mutual sorrow.
I'll present your case to my board.
Misho nodded slowly, contemplating his guest. You understand, the final decision on whether to support you or not will be theirs.
What will your recommendation be?
I'll have to consider that.
While you're considering it, consider this.
Crew tossed a thick folder onto Michaud's desk.
Thanks for your time.
He rose to leave and shook Michaud's hand. I hope we'll be working together.
Harmon Michaud watched him leave and then picked up the folder and looked at it. The title page read, Engineering Design.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?